The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. So welcome, welcome. It's nice to practice together. Today I'm joined by my good friend who's here in the hall with me. The two of us, we have this whole hall together. And all of you there on the other side of that camera. So with this practice, you might have heard, or sometimes I know that I've said in different settings, that part of this practice, the goal of practice, maybe we might say, is to see things as they really are, yata bhuta, as they really are. Kind of like the truth of the moment, not how we wish that they were or that we're imagining how they might be, but how they really are. And the tradition tells us that the way things really are impermanent, unsatisfactory, and without a self at the center of it all, anicca, dukkha, anatta. And then the idea is, and the teachings are, and certainly this has been my experience, that when there is this recognition of the truth of how things are, impermanent, unsatisfactory, without a steady self at the center of everything, then there's just this natural letting go that arises. It just doesn't seem, just doesn't make sense to hold on. It's less maybe a logic and more just a recognition, like, yeah, it just doesn't make sense to hold on. And so there's a letting go. And this letting go can bring greater freedom. So we might ask, well, why is it, if there's the truth of impermanence, not self, and suffering, why can't I see it all the time? Why do we have to do all this meditation and Dharma talks and study and all this work? Well, maybe I'll say a little bit more. Because we also have this idea of the Four Noble Truths. Maybe some different truths here. The truth of suffering, but also the truth of its cause, its cessation, and the way, the path leading to the cessation. And these have this title, Noble Truth. So these feel like really important truths, and certainly they are foundational to the Buddhist teachings and Buddhist practice. And these truths overlap with some of those other truths about anicca, anatta, dukkha, impermanence, not self, suffering. So we might begin to think that, okay, this idea about truth is an integral part, is an important part of practice. And recently I've heard in a number of different settings also this story, I'll say, or that the tradition holds, that the Buddha had countless lives, past lives, before he became a Buddha, and he's reborn in all these different venues or settings, and it is said that despite these hundreds, thousands, untold number, I don't know how many, I don't know if maybe the nobody knows, that the Buddha never told a lie throughout all these rebirths, because truth is so important that even though he might have done some other transgressions, he didn't tell a lie. I've heard this a number of times, including just recently. Just as a little aside, I'll say it's not, that itself is not actually true, that there is a Jataka story, the Vanara Jataka, Jataka 342, that when the Bodhisattva, so before he was a Buddha, in that particular life he was a monkey, and he was deceived a crocodile in that story. So just as a little aside, turns out that the that Buddha, in one of his past lives, according to these Jataka tales, in fact did lie. But nevertheless, the tradition believes and holds that it's so important that they have this tradition that he didn't lie. So we might be led to believe that this practice is about getting to the truth. And certainly that feels good, right? That we want to know what the truth is. We don't want to be following lies or something like this. And maybe we even have this idea it's the truth with a capital T. The truth. But this type of thinking lends itself to the idea that there's a truth that's out there somewhere and that we have to discover it and find it. And it's certainly the practice is about that, but one way that if we were to do this, it can leave us feeling maybe disconnected, that there's some great truth out there. There's me over here, and out over there is something that I'm supposed to discover. And this is a legitimate way to consider Buddhist philosophy, certainly. But in this tradition, we were really highlighting practice. So the truth is naturally, necessarily subjective. It's the truth of the things as we experience them. So we can try to say how things are out there, quote unquote, but when the mind always makes sense of the world through perceptions and through the lenses of conditioning, so my experience at any moment is not going to be exactly the same as anybody else's experience. And in this early Buddhism, the Buddha is not concerned with the ontological status of things. That is to say, how things exist independent of any humans interacting with them. Instead, this practice really focuses on the truth of our experience, the truth of the moment. In fact, we might even say that mindfulness practice, it was really a practice to help us tune into and align with this moment, the truth of this moment, the reality of this moment. So instead of approaching this idea of truth from this idea that it's something to be had out there somewhere, but instead turn it around, think about it's more as the truth, as an antidote to self-delusion. Truth as a way to help us see our experience clearly, help us see ourselves clearly. We might say that the practice is really just a commitment to look deeply into whatever is arising. And I appreciate very much Matthew Brentsilver. Sometime last year he gave this talk about this idea, and he highlighted that when we first begin the question, or when we're beginning practice, we could say the question is, what is it like to be human? What is it actually like? Not what do we think it should be, or how we imagine it might be, or how we have been told it should be, but what is it? What is the truth of this human's experience? And in this way, practice is to like stop fooling ourselves or wishing that things were different, but to really see the truthfully about our own minds. And we can ask ourselves, are we really seeing ourselves truthfully? Instead of trying to go find the truth out there, are we really seeing ourselves clearly? And this is what practice is about. So when we look in this way, we might discover, perhaps to our horror, that we're doing a lot of rationalizing. rationalizing our habits, rationalizing our preferences. Maybe this is one of the humbling aspects of practice, is to see how much of our lives are rationalizations of our conditions and our preferences. It wasn't until Matthew kind of highlighted this that I really saw it, but I think I have to agree. Of course, through our conditioning, we have certain ways in which we like to be seen or experiences we like to have. We have preferences. And often we're just kind of maybe not like noticing some of those maybe unflattering things that we might see in ourselves. Instead, we might rationalize them. Oh, yeah, but I'm just that way because we have a reason. Of course, we have a reason. But there might be a way in which we don't really see all that's going on in our minds. Maybe we have this idea that we're like scientists, and that scientists have a hypothesis, like, I wonder what's in the mind, and then they conduct experiments to see. And they conduct these experiments not necessarily knowing what they're going to find. They set up something like a clinical trial or something like this, right? And then when the experiment is finished, they look to see what the results are. So many of us might think that we're doing this with our own minds, our own experience. But I kind of chuckled when I heard Matthew say, they said that what happens is that many of us, instead of being scientists, are more like lawyers, in the sense that lawyers have a conclusion that they need to have, and then they find the data to support it. So we all have as conclusions about ourselves, these ideas that we think about ourselves. I'm a good person, I'm a bad person, I'm a kind person, I'm not so kind, I'm generous, I'm selfish. Whatever these ideas that we have, they're all about kind of like this self and our ideas about ourselves. And so often, of course, when we look in our minds, when we look in our experience, we are seeing data that supports the way that we think about ourselves. Whether that way we think about it is flattering or unflattering. So we're not maybe seeing the truth of ourselves, the entirety of ourselves, perhaps. And maybe we would say, specifically, we often don't see the expression of some of these unwholesome roots or defilements. I'm not so keen on this word defilements. It sounds pejorative. And to be sure, the unwholesome roots are not fantastic, I should say. But it is part of what it means to be human, is to have these unwholesome roots, these unskillful roots. And the Buddha recognized this. And he gave this simile of the cloth as one way to describe it. And it goes like this. Suppose a cloth were defiled and stained, and a dyer, someone that would dye things, and a dyer dipped it in some dye or other, whether blue or yellow or red or carmine, it would look poorly dyed and impure in color. Why is that? Because of the impurity of the cloth. So too, when the mind is defiled, soiled, we might say, an unhappy outcome might be expected. So the Buddha is pointing out that as long as we have these in our minds, then, you know, the outcome is not going to be as if it weren't there, of course. And so to maybe speak a little bit more specifically, the Buddha gives this long list of these unwholesome roots, or you can say imperfections that stain the mind. And I've looked at a number of different translators looking at this long list, and it's fun to see how different they all are on some of these words, because they're not so common, and maybe we don't quite know how to translate them into English. So to hold these loosely, but to give you a sense of what's being pointed at here. So this list of 16, we could maybe say kalesas, defilements, unwholesome states, unbalanced greed, anger, resentment, contempt, spite, envy, meanness, deceit, treachery, stubbornness, rivalry, conceit, arrogance, vanity, longing, and carelessness. Sometimes if we were to see something like this in our minds, this can be this dance between revelation and denial. Oh, I see, I have this quality. No, I don't. Or, you know, it can be a sense of a flash or a flicker. I see this, oh, I don't see it. Maybe I do have this, maybe I don't. It can also be the opposite, right? Where we can see that we have some of these states and then we just grab onto it and take on a new identity. I'm the one who is filled with envy. I'm the one who has rivalry, whatever it might be. So many of you know that we can simplify this list to three: greed, hatred, and delusion. These unholes the roots of all other of the defilements. And maybe we can say that a delusion is a way in which kind of helps us not see our greed and our hatred and all the different forms that it takes. So truth, like this practice of working with truth, can be an antidote to self-delusion. It's a way in which we can really understand ourselves better, not so that we can beat ourselves up better, not so that we can finally find that data that proves that we're a bad person or something like this, just so that we can wash this cloth that has some stains on it. And so one way that we could say that maybe we could play with this analogy that there's some pre-treatments before we do some of this washing. There used to be this product, I'm not sure if it still exists, called like spray and wash, right? You could like put it on the cloth before you put the cloth into the laundry, into the wash. So some things that might help with some pre-treatment of if we find some of these states in our minds: loving kindness practice, because it takes a lot of warmth, care, and compassion, not to mention courage, but warmth, care, and compassion to do this work, this mindfulness, and to really see how things are. That sometimes we do have flickers of anger or flickers of conceit. Doesn't make us a bad person. It makes us human. And part of this practice is just to help, you know, loosen up some of these stains, some of the ways in which the beauty of the heart and mind might have a little bit of specks, some soil on them. So loving kindness practice, compassion practice, any of the heart practices, fabulous pre-treatment to help these come out. Another one, concentration practice. And I don't know how this works exactly, but if the mind has an opportunity to settle, and we have an opportunity to feel some well-being, to feel some happiness, to feel some contentment, even if it's just a little bit. That's a way in which helps these everything else to come out in the wash, so to speak. So one way to work with these kleshas, these defilements, these unwholesome roots, is with loving kindness practice, concentration practice, as well as mindfulness practice. And it can be helpful to work with just one at a time instead of feeling like, oh my gosh, I see everything there, that whole list of 16, I've maybe at times have seen it, or maybe not too, right? But maybe just to choose one, I'm going to notice the rivalry. Just when does that show up for me? Is it a habit of mind? Maybe it says something that I learned long ago and is no longer helpful. Just doesn't make sense anymore. So maybe to just choose one, if you notice it, and just notice how it shows up in your daily life, how it shows up in meditation, with a warm heart, right? This is so key. This is so key, right? This practice is not about beating ourselves up. It's not about making ourselves feel bad. Freedom, getting this cloth clean, is freedom, complete freedom. And it is possible. So we can just work with these a little bit as we see them in a warm-hearted way. In the same way that we're looking at some of these defilements, we should and can also ask, are we acknowledging what is wholesome? We also acknowledging what is wholesome, right? The practice is to be, what is it like to be a human? Humans have wholesome qualities too. So sometimes we might just not be seeing the unwholesome. Sometimes we might not be seeing the wholesome. So just to acknowledge that there's both sides, and the practice is to see maybe the breadth of our experiences. And to keep compassion as a companion in this investigation. And I'd like to share this poem by Rosemary Traumer. I appreciate Rosemary Traumer very much. Her poetry is touching, is beautiful. In a way that I appreciate, maybe not for everybody, but this is a poem that she wrote on January 24th, 2021, less than a year ago. And it's called Choosing Truth. And it goes like this. And if I find I'd rather not meet the truth, then I can notice the little girl in me, the one who hides in the closet when she is afraid, the one who plays dead, the one who ends all her stories with happily ever after. And I can choose to love her. I don't need to drag her out or force her to look or to tell her that sometimes the villain wins in the end. Instead, I can remind the rest of me how alive I feel when I meet it all. When I choose to enter the day, eyes open, ears open, hands open, and let the world in. That is how on this day, when I know the truth of how cruel we humans can be, I can lean into that pain at the same time I watch the sky turn pink behind the white aspen, and feel the cold air kiss my cheeks, my breath rising in visible prayer, meeting difficult truths I walk right through. This is practice. I think this is a beautiful way to describe practice. We discover things that are uncomfortable, difficult about ourselves, about others, about life. And we don't beat ourselves up. I appreciate very much that Rosemary Traumer writes, "Instead, I can remind the rest of me how alive I feel when I meet it all." There's a way in which if we're not telling the truth or seeing the truth or holding the truth intentionally, there's a way in which there's a secret somewhere that we're trying to keep away from others, keep away from ourselves. And when we hold secrets, there's a little bit of a deadening maybe, something that we're trying to lose contact with. But Rosemary Traumer writes, "I don't need to drag her out or force her to look or tell her that sometimes the villain wins in the end. Instead, I can remind the rest of me how alive I feel when I meet it all, when I choose to enter the day eyes open, ears open, hands open, and let the world in." If I find I'd rather not meet the truth, then I can notice the little girl in me, the one who hides in the closet when she is afraid, the one who plays dead, the one who ends all her stories with happily ever after, and I can choose to love her. So truth as an antidote to self-delusion. Maybe love is another antidote to self-delusion. Maybe if we have love and compassion, it's a way in which there can be an opening to see that which might be difficult to see, to hold what might be difficult to hold. So we might have all these different ideas about truth, and we might have this idea that we want to see or find truth with a capital T, and this belief that we're going to find it somewhere and it's going to make us happy. We may not know what truth with a capital T is, but we do know what honesty is. And that's what this practice is asking of us, to be with our experience, to see the truth of our experience, and to be as honest as we can. Bathed in care, bathed in love, bathed in compassion, bathed in warmth, to increase the capacity to see everything and use a little pre-treatment on any cloth that has a stain that needs to be cleaned. So in this way, we can show up for our lives, we can show up for others, we can show up in this world that is of benefit and support for all beings everywhere. Thank you.